All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Torah Study Special Edition Chanukah class. So, although we have the chumashim out, tonight we won't need them because it's all about the Chanukah candles. And we've got a wonderful discussion, psychological, Talmudic, legal. It's got everything. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll eat some more jelly donuts, and you'll cry some more. Okay, so let's start with a very basic idea. And that is that a lot of what we take for granted about Judaism has a source. What I mean by has a source, what I mean is that a lot of the things that we take for granted about Jewish practice, tradition, Jewish law, actually is a subject of Talmudic debate in the source. In other words, it comes from somewhere, and in that source, oftentimes, there's a debate about how to do it. Now, we do it one way, but there might be another alternative, another way, another path, another method of how to do it. So one great example of this is Chanukah. So everybody knows that how do you celebrate the holiday of Chanukah? What do? You eat latkes, right? Oh, okay. You light the menorah, right? We light the menorah because of the miracle of the oil. However, what some may not know, and maybe y'all know, but some people don't know this, that there's actually a Talmudic debate as to how you light the candles. Go to any Jewish home that's lighting a menorah on the first night, and they're lighting how many candles? One. And on the second night, how many are they lighting? Two. And the third night, three. There is a great debate. A great debate that opens up incredible insight into psychology, spirituality, and into our lives as well. And this is the entry point into our discussion. Let's begin with text 1a from the Talmud Tractate Shabbat. We're going to present a dispute between the Academy of Hillel and the Academy of Shammai. Hillel and Shammai were great sages. They were scholars. They lived in the time period of the second temple, the second Beit HaMikdash. They actually lived before the temple was destroyed. So they saw the temple. Not only that. Hillel and Shammai lived about 55 to 60 years. They were born 55 to 60 years after the story of Chanukah. So you think sometimes you think the story of Chanukah is like an ancient story. Hillel and Shammai are also ancient. They lived a long time ago. And Hillel and Shammai, again, were born just about a half a century after the story of Chanukah took place. Their academies, each of them was a scholar, and each of them built a Torah scholarship academy. They built their own yeshiva. And their yeshivot, their schools, had oftentimes many arguments. Hillel and Shammai themselves only are recorded to have three disputes. When I say disputes of Jewish law, three, between Hillel and Shammai themselves. But their academies, hundreds. Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai, which means, Beit means like the house, but it's the academy. Academy of Hillel, Academy of Shammai. And here is one such dispute about in the first century, sort of the first century after the story of Chanukah. The question is, well, how are we going to celebrate this miracle? How are we going to set this holiday? And here's the dispute as recorded in the Talmud. Tractate Shabbat, Mike, take it away, please. Page 208.
Our rabbis taught the mitzvahs of Hanukkah demand one light for a man and his household. Those who beautify the mitzvah kindle a light for each member of the household. And concerning those who beautify it more than that, Beit Shammai says, on the first day, light eight, and after that, gradually reduce. But Beit Hillel says, on the first day, one is lit, and thereafter, they are progressively increased.
Okay, so the Talmud here describes three ways to do the mitzvah. There's the basic, there is the extra special, and then there's the extra, extra special. Nice. Are these warm? These are the warm version from the oven.
This is really tempting.
Oh. I mean, it's all part of...
It's all part of the experience.
It's all part of the experience.
That's it. Okay, so three levels. The basic level is that every night of Chanukah, every household lights one candle. The first night, how many candles? The basic mitzvah. One. The second night, how many candles? One. Third night, one. One per family household. Which means that you would have in your house a candlestick holder or whatever, a lamp, and you would light one candle every night of Hanukkah. For 8 nights, you would light that one candle. That's the basic observance. The Talmud says, Mahadrin, if you want to go extra special, then one candle for each member of the household. So if you have a family of four, so the first night of Hanukkah, how many candles would you light?
Four.
One for each member of the household. And the second night, how many? Four. Right? Still the same amount every night. So the first way of doing it, the basic way, is one per household. Next step up is one per person in the household. So family of six, six the first night, six the second night, six the third night, into the eighth night. Same number every night. V'hamahadrin, min hamahadrin, the Talmud says, if you want to go extra special, three levels, then what you're going to do is light one candle per person the first night, and then the second night, increase it, according to Beit Hillel. According to Beit Shammai, reverse it, although he's mentioned first. Eight candles per person the first night, seven the second night, six the third night, etc. So Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, so Shammai says, start off eight, decrease. Hillel says, you're going up, right? So that's it. Hillel and Shammai.
Wait a minute. So if you had, like in your family, you'd start the first night, you had eight, six candles.
That's how we do it. Oh, you're saying the first night, yeah. Well, by the eighth night, we have, not that everyone lights, I mean, baby doesn't light. Whatever, but
each one has their own menorah,
yeah. And when you add them all together, it's a lot of light. So Shammai says, get all the lights going first night and then decrease. Hill says, you're going up. The question is why? Why is this the subject of dispute? And the real answer is because we can. Joking, that's not the real answer. But although it seems like sometimes, because we're Jews, that's because, yeah, like why not? But so the Talmud continues to ask the question, about why are they disagreeing? Like, what's this? You can't just tell me that they're saying, you know, one says this way, one says that way. There's got to be a rationale for it. So the Talmud gives the explanation of what's the rationale. Amazingly enough, there's a dispute as to what the rationale is. You understand what's going on? There's a dispute as to what's driving the dispute. That's how Jewish this discussion is. That's how you know you're studying Talmud. When not only is there a dispute, but in trying to get to the bottom of the dispute, there's a dispute about that as well. Take a look at text 1b. Mike, please continue. Ula.
Ula said, in Israel, two scholars, Rabbi Yossi, the son of Avin, and Rabbi Yossi, the son of Zvida, argue. One maintains the reason of Beit Shammai is that it should correspond to the days still to come. And the reason for Beit Hillel is that it should correspond to the days that have already passed. But the other scholar maintains, Beit Shammai, reason is that it should correspond to the bull's offering of Sukkot. Well, Beit Hillel's reason is that we increase in matter of sanctity, but never decrease.
So here we have two opinions as to the rationale for the two opinions. So let's start with the first one, Rabbi Yossi ben Avin. Rabbi Yossi, the son of Avin. He says like this, Shammai, who says go down, and Hillel, who says go up, here's the reason why. Shammai is saying, first night of Hanukkah. How many days do we still have to come? How many days of Hanukkah are we still yet to celebrate? First night. Hanukkah began Saturday night. Right? The holiday begins Saturday night. First day of Hanukkah is really Sunday. Right? So first night, Saturday night. How many days of Hanukkah are we yet to celebrate?
Oh,
eight. So he says, so light eight candles. And then the second night, Sunday night, how many days are left? Seven. And then how many days are left the next night? Six. So you're counting down, so to speak, of how many days are left for the miracle. And Beit Hillel counts the other way. Beit Hillel says, okay, first night of Hanukkah, how many days have we entered? One. It hasn't passed yet, right? It's still before the first day. But how many days have we, gone into? One. Second night of Hanukkah, how many days are we entering? Two. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So that's why Shammai says, you look at the days yet to come, And Hillel says you look at the days that have already arrived. That's one rationale. The second scholar says, Rabbi Yossi ben Zavida, Rabbi Yossi the son of Zavida says, no, different rationale. He says, Shammai who says you decrease 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, because it corresponds to the bull offering on Sukkot. The bulls of Sukkot, the Torah says, it's a biblical commandment, that every day of Sukkot, it's an 8-day holiday, 7 days, it's really a 7-day holiday, and then Shemini Atzeret, the special 8th day, 7-day holiday, the first 7 days, there are different amounts of bulls brought every day as an offering. The first day was 13, and then 12, and then 11, 10, 9, so 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7. If you add them up together, you should get, assuming that we're correct here with the math, you should get 70. So there were 70 bulls brought on Sukkot. Is anybody fact-checking me? Is the math? Are you fact-checing me? 13 plus 12 plus 11 plus 10 plus 9 plus 8 plus 7? 70? Is that right? It needs to be. It should be right. So, since the Torah sets a precedent of starting high and going low, so Shammai says, do the same thing with Hanukkah. Start off with 8 candles, and then go 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Hillel says, no. When it comes to matters of holiness, Ma'ilin B'Kodesh Ve'ei Meridin. He says you always seek to go higher when it comes to like holy good things, and you never want to go down. Like you never want to do a mitzvah today and then tomorrow, I'm going to flake out. No, you want to increase in matters of holiness and always add and always go higher. It's in general, it's a good thing in life to always strive to go higher, especially in matters of holiness. So Hillel says, no, you don't start off with 8 and then go down to 1 at the end. You start with 1 and you go up to 8. And that's how the Talmud ends it. Does it make sense? Two ways of explaining the dispute.
So what does Hillel say about the bulls?
What does Shammai say about the increasing?
No.
I'm with you. Each one has a question that the other... In other words, each one, you can ask on each one about the other guy. In other words, according to Shammai, and we're about to do that. According to Shammai, the question is, well, what do you do about this rule of always ascending in matters of holiness? According to Hillel, what do you do with the bulls? But the questions are even more nuanced than that, which we'll get to in a second. Let's first question the first rationale that's given. The first rationale is that one is looking at the days still to come, and one is looking at the days that have come. Or that are, you know, that have initially arrived. Okay. So here's the question. Are they disputing about how to count?
No.
It's like New Year's, right? Do you count 1 to 10 and then drop the ball? Or you count 10 down to 1? It's like, really? This is that important to have a Talmudic dispute about? And not even to have a dispute, but to really say that the mitzvah should be done either this way or that way. Because they're arguing about how to count. Do you count the days coming in or the days yet to come or the days that have come? I mean, that's important enough to create a distinction in Jewish law? That's the first question. Second question is, or the question on the second opinion as to the dispute is, okay, number one, why is Beit Shammai drawing a comparison between the Hanukkah candles, the Hanukkah lamps, and the bull offering on Sukkot? Like, what's the conceptual connection? It's like, oh, because the bull, such an obscure reference. It's like, because the Torah says that on Sukkot, the bull should be brought, the number of bulls that are offered in the temple should go in decreasing numbers, 13, 12, 11. So therefore, Hanukkah should also be the same way. Why? Like, what's the connection? Why don't you say, well, on the shofar and Rosh Hashanah, you make first one sound, the tekiah, and then 3 small sounds, and then 9 smaller sounds. Oh, so you go 1, 3, 9, so you're going up. I mean, like, what's he throwing at? You understand the question?
Yeah.
Why suddenly is it like, oh, wait, don't forget about the bulls of Sukkot. That's how we should light the Hanukkah menorah. Makesh, like, what's the connection? And then, according to Hillel, especially if you consider that in general, when it comes to holiness, we always increase. We never want to go down. You don't want to be in a downward trend when it comes to like holy spiritual things. You always want to go up. So you may have found a bulls of Sukkot precedent, but number one, what's the correlation between the bulls of Sukkot and the Hanukkah lamps, number one. Number two, how does Hillel, who's citing this general rule of always going up and not going down, how does he explain the bulls of Sukkot? Or how do we explain the bulls of Sukkot? If there's a general rule that you always go up in matters of holiness, then why were the bulls of Sukkot designed in a way that they should go down? Make sense? All the questions? So let's recap what we're up to, because we're about to get into the real good stuff. We cited the Talmud. The Talmud sets out a dispute, classic dispute, on that greatest level of observing the Hanukkah mitzvah. So you light candles for every person in the family that move, that change each night. So it's not one static candle per household. It's not one static candle per person per household. It's a dynamic lighting of the menorah, different numbers of candles each night. But how does it work? Shammai says, the Academy of Shammai says, you go down, 8, 7, 6, 12, 4, 3, 2, 1. The Academy of Hillel says, you go up, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. The Talmud asks, why the distinction, or why the dispute? Two reasons are given, either because you're counting the days yet to come, or the days that have come, or because you're comparing it to the bulls of Sukkot, or you're following the general rule of always going up. To which we asked, are they count? Well, they don't know how, different opinions of counting. That's ridiculous. I mean,
a lot of questions.
And the second question is, on the second opinion, why the comparison for the between the bulls and Hanukkah, between Sukkot and Hanukkah, and what about this idea of adding, of increasing in matters of holiness? How does that work with the decreasing number of bulls of Sukkot? So to understand this, we need to get into the psychology of the opinions of Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, which we'll better understand by looking at the personalities of their founders. Right? The Academy of Shammai was founded by Shammai, and the Academy of Hillel was founded by Hillel. So to understand their divergent opinions on the Hanukkah candles, as well as other disputes that they have, these two academies, it's helpful to understand the personalities of their founders, respectively Shammai and Hillel. So Shammai is known, personality-wise, to be strict. Very stern, very strict. He's the disciplinarian. He's the guy, as we have in text number two, that when somebody comes to him and says, oh, teach me Torah on one foot, he chases them out. He says, get away from, you know, get out of here. Whereas Hillel is known to be a person of love, kindness, and giving. Text number two, here's the story that I'm referring to. Text number two, Talmud tractate Shabbat. And actually, the quote from Hanukkah, the quote regarding Hanukkah from the Talmud is also from the same tractate, Shabbat, but that's page 20, 21b, this is 31a. So 10 pages later, we have the story about Shammai and Hillel. Amy.
It happened that a certain non-Jew came before Shammai and said to him, convert me on the condition that you teach me the whole Torah while I stand on one foot. Thereupon, he chased him away with the builder's measuring tool that was in his hand. The same fellow came before Hillel, and Hillel converted him, saying, that which is despicable to you, do not do to your fellow. This is the whole Torah, and the rest is commentary. Go and learn.
Okay, so Shammai and Hillel are approached by this fellow who is seeking to convert. Shammai says, what kind of thing is this? What kind of demand? The whole Torah on one foot, get out of here. And Hillel says, all right, we can work with you. We can work with this. And he works with him, and everything is good. Okay, so clearly the Talmud is illustrating a different perspective. Shammai is a disciplinarian, stern. In Kabbalistic terminology, which I think we're all familiar with, he's a man of gevura, which means strength, but also discipline, boundaries, rules. And Hillel is a man of chesed, kindness, love, giving, openness, forgiving, etc. Okay, this is reflected in their respective rulings as well. When Shammai and Hillel, or Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, whether it's them or their academies, when they rule on matters of Jewish law, 99% of the time, Shammai takes a stricter approach, and Hillel takes a more lenient approach. Shammai is strict, Hillel is lenient. To the point that the Mishnah says, text number 3, we'll read this in a second, but let me give you the background here. The Mishnah says that there are a few instances where Beit Shammai is more lenient and Beit Hillel is more strict. In other words, it's the exception to the rule. So the rule is Beit Shammai, strict, just like Shammai. Strict, no messing around. And Hillel, or Beit Hillel, more lenient. Text number 3 is the exception.
The following are instances where Beit Shammai is more lenient and Beit Hillel is more strict.
And look how many instances are mentioned.
An egg that was laid on a festival, Beit Shammai says it may be eaten, and Beit Hillel says it may not be eaten.
This is an anomaly. That they would say, that Beit Shammai would say yes and Beit Hillel would say no. It's usually the other way around. That's why the Mishnah is specifying that, you know, here are the exceptions to the rule. So, an egg, I will explain the example soon. Continue, please.
Beit Shammai says a person is liable for a violation of Passover eating prohibitions with an olive-sized portion of yeast and a date-sized portion of leavened product. Beit Hillel says with an olive-sized portion each of yeast and leavened product.
So the question is, how much chametz, how much leaven stuff, what's the minimal amount that already you violated the prohibition about eating that on Passover? So Beit Shammai says an olive-sized portion of yeast or yeast product and a date-sized portion of leavened product. In other words, a smaller amount of the yeast and a larger amount of the leavened product will get you violating the prohibition, because dates are larger than olives. Is this true? They are. Yeah.
I mean, there's
some big olives. Like the olives that the spies brought back from, I don't know if they brought back olives, but if they did, it would have been like huge olives. Okay. All right, and what does Beit Hillel say? No, with, huh? Yeah.
There are colossal ones, really.
Right.
The black ones that are about.
Yeah. Are there king olives? Queen olives. What am I saying, king olives?
Queen are smaller.
Oh, queen are smaller. So which ones are the...
They're colossal. They're black.
I feel like I need to go to Publix.
Go to the Whole Foods.
Guys, let's go. That's it. Field trip.
Jinx.
Yeah, they are always on the bottom shelf. Yeah. Huh. It's a conspiracy. All right. Beit Hillel says, on the other hand, that no, an olive-sized portion of each will get you violating the prohibition. In other words, stay away. Even an olive-sized portion of leavened product... So he's more strict. He says even a little bit will already get you past the threshold of prohibition. So these are two rare instances where the Academy of Shammai is more lenient than the Academy of Hillel, which means that the rule of thumb is, just like their founders, the Academy of Shammai, strict. No, you can't. That's already crossing the line, right? That's their general approach. Beit Hillel, it's okay, we love you, it's fine, we'll let it slide this time. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but that's the general energy of Hillel, of Shammai and Hillel, and the Academy of Shammai and the Academy of Hillel. Now, let's advance this a little bit further. We know when there are disputes in the Talmud between the Academies of Shammai and Hillel, 99% of the time, the halacha, the law, follows Hillel, the Academy of Hillel. We always follow. How do we light the menorah? I mean, that's a great example, right? We light the menorah 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, like the Academy of Hillel. We don't light it. I've never met anyone that lights the menorah 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And by the way, even people that would say, oh, you know, we don't believe in the oral law, the oral tradition, they're still lighting the menorah. Everyone does it. So everyone believes in the Talmud, even if they don't, you know, even if they say they don't believe in it.
And who came up with the one per person in the household? Does that matter?
The Talmud says that the sages that established the holiday, remember this, the story of Hanukkah and the establishment of it as a holiday happened right in that time period, mm-hmm. in that generation or two. So those sages were discussing how to do it. So they said like this, and this was a consensus. They all said, the basic mitzvah, Chanukah observance, one light per household. Who's it attributed to? The collective consensus of the sages. You want to get a little fancier? One per person per night. Super fancy. Make it dynamic. Make it change. How? Up or down? Oh, depending who you ask. Shammai says down, Hillel says up. Who are the first two opinions? It's not stated. It's understood to be, you know, that was the understanding. That was the consensus. Basically, the sages, when they established it, they basically said you can observe this holiday in different ways. Choose your own path. It's interesting when it comes to Hanukkah, no one lights one candle per night. No one lights like Shammai, but no one lights one either per night. No one sits there at Hanukkah with a candlestick, with one candle. Happy Hanukkah, folks! Shh, we're done. All 8 nights. Doesn't happen. Everyone does Mahajim and Amah. When it comes to any other mitzvah, this is just parenthetical, because you asked. When it comes to any other mitzvah, there are variations about how people observe the mitzvah. You know, some people do it basic, some people go all out, you know, how you buy your esrog, you know, how much money do you spend on an esrog, how you, you know, matzah, machine-made, handmade, you know, the cheaper, the more expensive. There's variations in how people observe it. When it comes to Hanukkah, I've never met anyone that doesn't do it, the mahadrim and a mahadrim. When it comes to kosher, so there's glat, there's not glat, there's chol of Yisrael, there's pasher, there's different levels of kosher. And there's a great spectrum of observance and practice. Hanukkah is very unique, and it's very telling, in my opinion, that everyone that's observing it is doing it mahadrim and a mahadrim, the best of the best. Everyone, that exception. And they're following Hillel as well. Anyway, so why is it telling? We can remind me later, we can fabrang about that a little bit and say, like, what's the significance of why Hanukkah of all holidays, of all mitzvahs, of all observances, why that got, like, there's like bronze, silver, gold with every mitzvah. Everyone goes for the gold for this one. We'll pick that up. Let's take a look at text number 4. Oh, Joan, you're skipping. You're passing the baton?
Yeah, I don't have my glasses.
Oh, it's fine. I mentioned an Olympics reference of bronze, silver, gold. You can pass the torch. It's fine. All right. Yes.
I want to get this straight. So
yes.
Tonight.
Yes.
Today we light 5 candles.
Tonight 5. Yeah. Why?
Don't light 3.
Say it again.
Don't light 3. So even if you go to hello, you're lighting 5.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I'm going to be a contrarian.
Oh, you're going
to say to you, no, I'm not lighting 3.
You're saying, I'm not going to light 3. Right, so you're looking at the other way. But Shammai would say, you know, I'm with you. Shammai would say that tonight you light 3. And we're saying we're not lighting 3. Right? We're going against Shammai. All right, Steve, page 212, text number 4, again, another Talmudic statement. Oh, this is about how the halacha was decided. Halacha is the final ruling of Jewish law, and although there were many disputes between the academies of Shammai and Hillel, hundreds of disputes, at the end of the day, we had to pick one, and the one that we picked traditionally, typically, was Hillel.
For 3 years, the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai argued. One said the halacha is like us, and the other said the halacha is like us. A heavenly voice spoke, "These and these are the words of the living God," and the halacha follows the house of Hillel.
How beautiful is that? You should know, even though we're going to have to pick one, the heavenly voice says, both these and these, elu ve'elu, divrei Elokim Chaim, are the words of Hashem. In other words, they all have their place within God's truth and God's wisdom. Although the halacha is like Hillel, Shammai also has his place. Continue, please.
A question was raised. Since the heavenly voice declared, both these and those are the words of the living God, why was the halacha established to follow the opinion of Hillel? It is because the students of Hillel were kind and gracious. They taught their own ideas as well as the ideas of the students of Shammai. They not only that, they went so far as to teach Shammai's opinions first.
Look at that. In their own academies, when they would discuss Jewish law, they would say both opinions. They wouldn't just say, well, this is what we think. They would say their opinion and Shammai's opinion, the Academy of Shammai's opinion. Not only that, they put their opinions first. So when they got to a matter of Jewish law, they would say, this is the case. The Academy of Shammai teaches this way, and we teach the other way. There was respect and kindness and love and appreciation that the students of Hillel had for everyone, including the students of Shammai, and it's because of that that the majority sided with them, and they became canonized as the halacha, as the final opinion or the final path of Jewish law. Okay, good. Now, here we go. So Hillel and Shammai have different perspectives. Clearly, one is chesed, Hillel is chesed, kindness, Shammai is gevura. The question is, how does that help us with the Hanukkah candles? How does that help us understand the dispute? Because Shammai is more gevura, because Shammai is sterner, so is more strict, stringent. So therefore, you start off with 8 and go down to 1. Like, what's the connection? And because Hillel is kinder, so you start off with 1 and go to 8. Like, what's... there's something missing. In other words, what we just explained, the dynamic or the, you know, the dynamic that drives the debates between Hillel and Shammai, that one is chesed and one is gevura, one is kind, one is stern, that can help some disputes, but that doesn't seem to help our dispute. Why go up? Why go down or go up based on that? That doesn't, like, what's the connection? So to understand this, we need to introduce one more idea. One more idea that distinguishes Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. And that is that Shammai, so take this idea of strict versus lenient, put it aside for a second, we're going to get back to it and connect it. But let's introduce one more idea. And the new idea is, and this is amazing because you can look through almost through all the debates of the Talmud between the academies of Shammai and Hillel, and you can weave this thread. This thread runs through pretty much all of them. The Academy of Shammai always looks at things in potential, and Beit Hillel always looks at things in actual. It's either potential or practical. In other words, like reality, what's in front of you? Nowhere is this expressed more than our dispute about the menorah, about Hanukkah, right? What is Shammai saying? How many do you like the first night? Why 8? What's the potential? What, let's connect with the potential. Why is it potential? Because the first night of Hanukkah, how much potential did the oil... now, they didn't know how long it was going to last, but if, in retrospect, how much fuel did that oil contain, miraculously, that first night?
Just one day.
No, no. Potentially.
It had 8.
Yeah. It had 8. Yeah. Correct? In other words, when they lit it the first night, or when we light, whatever, the miracle, right? When they lit the menorah in the temple, that first night, it had enough fuel, miraculously, to light for 8 nights. Now, they didn't see that potential play out until it actually played out each night and was lit every day of Hanukkah for 8 days. But the point is that first night, there's 8 days of miracle. For us, the first night of Hanukkah, how many days are there yet to come for the holiday?
7.
Well, 8,
yes.
Yeah, you can't... theoretically 7, but that's only for counting the first one is already happening. But if you're looking potential, so you haven't wrapped the first day yet, you haven't concluded the first day, so how many days are going to unfold from this moment? 8. So Beit Shammai looks at potential. Potentially, the first night of Hanukkah, how much more is there to unfold? 8. So how many do you light? 8. The second night of Hanukkah, how much potential is left? 7. And then 6. And then 5, and then 4, etc. You get the picture, it goes down. Beit Hillel always looks at actual, practical, reality, what's in front of you. Don't tell me potential, shmetential. Don't give me any of that. Tell me what I see in front of me. So how many days of Hanukkah do I see in front of me? How many days do I have right now? I'm lighting the menorah now. What am I doing right now? How many days am I lighting? How many days am I bringing in practically? 1. And the second night, how many days have been brought practically? Not how many are yet to come. How many have been brought in? 1 and now 2. And the third night, 1 and 2 and now 3. So Beit Hillel, second opinion, always looks at things in front of us. Don't tell me what's going to happen or what could happen or what may happen. But what's happening? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Beit Shammai says, potential. Look at what's going to happen. Let's give a clear illustration. Now, with Hanukkah, it's easy. But if you, I want to give you the, I want to give you the language of this. Just file this away. It's very interesting. There are many books that have been written on this subject, and many scholarly essays that have done this, including essays and talks by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, where Hillel and Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai, the disputes are broken down into this duality: potential versus actual. In Hebrew terminology, it's koach and poel. Koach, you may know, means strength, but it doesn't always mean strength. Koach means also potential. Potential. Koach. Potential. When you talk about a person's strength, it could either mean because they're picking up something, or because it means they have that power to do something, like the powers of the soul. Kochot ha-nefesh, plural, powers of the soul. It doesn't mean necessarily that the soul is using all the powers, but it means it's the potential powers that the soul could use. The abilities that you have are called kochot, powers. Not because you're utilizing all of them, but because you could utilize all of them. So koach means potential. That's what Beit Shammai focuses on, koach, potential. And Beit Hillel, poel, practical. Poel means action. Poel means what you're affecting, what you're actually doing. So I know in physics, there is energy, right? So there's kinetic, and what's the other one? Potential. So there's potential energy, is koach. Kinetic energy is the energy that's actually being expended or in motion. That's kinetic, that's poel. So koach, poel, potential, kinetic, potential, actual. This duality explains almost every dispute of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai in incredible ways. Let's skip a text. We're going to get back. We're going to skip a few texts. We're going to go back to one that I really love. Oh, actually, I'm sorry. Let's read text number 5. This is from the Rebbe's talks where this idea is clearly specified. Just so you know, I'm not making this up. Text 5, Marnine, please read this one, 2:13. And again, the classic example of Hanukkah is potentially the first night of Hanukkah. We have 8 more days, and practically we have the first day. So 8 or 1. Skip text 6. Skip text 7. I want you to go to text number 8. This is a law of honeycombs. Okay, not the cereal. Okay, here's the deal with honeycombs. First of all, an introduction of Jewish law. So in Jewish law, certain things can become impure if they come in contact with impurity. What's a form of impurity? Death. A non-kosher animal or rodent. There's different forms of impurity. Okay. But impurity doesn't cause to become impure anything, everything and anything. Certain things are susceptible to becoming impure. One of the things that allows something to become impure, not that makes it impure, but allows something to become impure if it then comes in contact with something impure, one of the steps of preparation so that something can be susceptible to becoming impure is liquid, water. If something has come in contact with water, it's now potentially ready to become impure. Or if it's a liquid, if it's something liquid, not necessarily water, anything liquid creates a status where it now can become impure. The question is regarding a honeycomb. Is a honeycomb a solid or a liquid? You ever seen a honeycomb? You've all seen honeycombs, right? Honeycomb has structure. Inside of it is honey. Honey's a liquid, but the structure of a honeycomb is a solid. So the question is it a solid? Is it a liquid? So who cares? Who cares? Here's why we care. What happens if a mouse crawls... Okay, it's kind of gross. Whatever. What happens if, you know, something impure comes in contact with the honeycomb? Is the honeycomb impure or is it not impure? The honeycomb, right? We know what a honeycomb is, right? Not the honeycomb stick thing that we move, but the actual honeycomb structure that you can take with a fork or whatever and just and crush it and eat it, right? It's got this stuff. So the question is it a solid? Is it a liquid? The Talmud asked, the Mishnah asked this question, text number 8. Howard, please read this one. Text number 8, 216.
Beginning, when do honeycombs become susceptible to being rendered impure as liquid?
In other words, when do they gain the status of a liquid to then become susceptible to impurity? Not that that makes them impure, but when do they come into that categorization of a liquid to then potentially become impure? Okay, continue, please.
Bet Shammai says, once one stirs it up by smoking the bees out or heating it, and Bet Hillel says, once one breaks it apart to remove the honey.
So here we have another dispute. Academy of Shammai says, the moment you get rid of the bees, it's a liquid. And Beit Hillel says, no, it's when you crush it and make it into a liquid that it's a liquid. What's the dispute? It's potential versus actual. Beit Shammai says, remember, Beit Shammai is the potential, Beit Hillel is the actual. Beit Shammai says, potentially this honeycomb, the moment the bees are gone, the moment you smoke the bees out, and all you're left with is the honeycomb with the honey, it's a liquid. Even if it's not a liquid, even if you haven't liquefied it, even if you haven't crushed it to make it a liquid, and it's still a structure, it's still a solid structure, you might as well consider it liquid. Potentially, you can take the honey whenever you want because there are no bees around. Now, if there are still bees around, it's not a liquid. Who's eating honey from a honeycomb, liquid honey from a honeycomb, as long as the bees are around? That's not a good move. My grandfather was in camp in the Catskills. I'm pretty sure this happened in camp. He was a young kid. Probably back, he was born in 1922, so I imagine the 30s. It's a long time ago. Anyway, and he was walking along and I think he saw a wasp or a yellow jack or some flying thing go into a hole in the ground. So he was fooling around, so he stepped on it. Next thing you know, a swarm of whatever they were, wasps or whatever, came after him, and he narrowly escaped and he got stung, whatever it was. A very harrowing and traumatic experience for him. Which he told me this story, he's told me this story many times. Okay, so it's not a good move to try to grab the honey while the bees are still around. So as long as the bees are around, it's not a liquid. The status is solid. Beit Shammai says once you get rid of the bees, it's a liquid. Even though you haven't crushed it, potentially you can get it any time. It's a liquid. Beit Hillel says it's not a liquid until you liquefy it, until you crush it, until you break it apart, you remove the honey. Then it becomes a liquid. Until then, it's still a solid. So here we see again, Beit Shammai, potential. Hillel, actual. Turn back to text number 6. I love this example.
So does this mean then if a mouse happened, or let's just say there's a rodent that goes after the honey,
yes,
while it's still in the comb,
yes,
still part of the comb.
Yes.
At that point, the bees are still there. We're not worried about the mouse.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Good luck if you're the mouse.
I know, right?
Swarm of bees. Yeah.
According to Shammai, if the bees have been smoked out, now a mouse.
It's impure. Correct.
According to Hillel,
it's not impure until you liquefy it.
Until
it's walking along and gets stuck. Beit Shammai would also say it's for sure impure as well, right?
Yeah.
Beit Shammai would say the status of potential impurity began already once the bees were gone. So for sure it's impure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, text number 6. I'll read this one. Talmud Erevin, a lot of Talmudic stuff. Check this out. Here's a dispute, one of the many disputes recorded between the two academies. A rabbi's taught for 2.5 years. The school of Shammai and the school of Hillel were in dispute. What was it about? The former, Shammai, asserting that it were better for man not to have been created than to have been created. It's better that we wouldn't have been created. That's what Shammai says, Beit Shammai. And the latter maintaining that it's better for man to have been created than to not have been created. Literally, this was an existential dispute. Beit Shammai says, we would have been better off having never been born. And Beit Hillel says, no, it's better off that we were born. What kind of dispute is this? What kind of random, what Beit Shammai is a bunch of like, sounds very depressing. They're like, oh, it's terrible. Life is the worst. I mean, like, what's he saying? And Beit Hillel says, no, everything's amazing. All right, what's going on? Maybe it sounds like their personalities, right? The Gvura says, oh, it's better that we wouldn't be. But there's another way of explaining a potential and actual. The way it's explained according to the Hasidic tradition is that the Academy of Shammai, again, is looking at the potential, and the Academy of Hillel is looking at the practical. You have to understand, before a person is born, the soul exists. It's not that when a person is born, that life begins. Life began well before, and life continues to exist after. True life begins before and exists after the body. The body is a temporary stop along the way for the soul's journey. It's just one part of a much larger journey. So the example that I've given before is electricity. So the refrigerator asks the electricity, where do we go when we die, when we get unplugged? And the electricity says to the refrigerator, I don't know where you go, but I don't go anywhere. Right? The electricity is still in the walls. You can plug an appliance in and unplug it. And as long as it's plugged in, it's going to turn on. When you unplug it, it's going to turn off. But the life force, i.e. the electricity, is a constant. So the same thing is true with the soul. The soul is alive. For a little while, relatively very little, it's connected with the body. So it makes the body alive. And when it's taken out, when the body is separated from the soul, the body dies, but the soul lives on. The question is like this. Is it better for the soul to come down into a body or to never bother with that experience altogether? That's the dispute. So Beit Shammai says it would be better had the soul remained above. And Beit Hillel says, no, it's good to come down. What's the dispute? You see, above in heaven, the soul is untested. The soul is close to God, but it's not hard to be close to God. When the soul comes down into a body, the soul is tested. What is the test? Will you be close to God, even in a body, in a physical world, with all of the other stuff going on? Right? With all of the other craziness and physical needs. Imagine, a soul above in heaven, all it needs to do is connect with God. Below, it now has to worry about eating and drinking and sleeping and earning money and buying stuff and shopping and Hanukkah presents, right? It's got all this stuff to worry about. The soul's like, do I need this in my life? But the soul has to do this stuff. The question is, will this soul, will your soul, will my soul still be connected with God even with the distractions? So, without the distractions of a physical existence, the soul is connected with God perfectly in heaven, no problem, there's no interference. The question is, can the soul maintain a level, some semblance of a level of dedication, devotion to God, even when it's dumped down into this world? Now, what that does is, that, in a sense, evokes and brings out a strength of the soul that you don't see above. You see, above, it's easy to be connected. Below, it's hard to be connected. So when the soul comes down, it shows how strong it is.
Is this a test?
I don't know if it's a test, but it's more of like it flexes the muscles of the soul. In other words, in heaven, the soul doesn't need to sprint. It floats. Below, it needs to work for it. It needs to schwitz. So therefore, therefore, the advantage of the soul coming down below is that it reveals its strength. It flexes its soul muscles that it wouldn't need to flex above. Hence the dispute. Beit Shammai says, you look at potential, which means that the soul's potential is that it could flex its muscles if it needed to. But if you're looking at potential, you don't need to actually do it. It still is strong. The soul is mighty. But how do you know? You have to send it down. Beit Shammai says you don't have to send it down. If your perspective is always to look at the potential and consider that to be right here, right now, right? Like Hanukkah, the first night you already have 8. The potential is right here. Beit Shammai doesn't have a divide between potential and actual. What's potential might as well be actual for Beit Shammai. So Beit Shammai says a soul above doesn't need to come down below to flex its muscles to see how strong it is. The fact that it's strong is a reality whether or not it ever flexes the muscles. So it's better that it shouldn't come down, because if it comes down, even though it actually flexes its muscles, but it also gets caught up in all sorts of mishigasin. It also gets it also gets, you know, beat up a little bit, slapped around a little bit. So it's better that it wouldn't be born, it wouldn't come down below, stay above. Ah, you don't know how strong it is? Oh, we know how strong it is. Potential, we don't need the actual. Beit Hillel says you go after the actual. Beit Hillel says, no. Unless it happened, unless someone took a selfie, didn't happen. Right? Unless it was actually put out there into the world, don't tell me potential, shmetential. Unless it happened, it didn't happen. So Beit Hillel says, of course the soul needs to come down below. Otherwise, how do you know how strong it is? You understand this explanation? Yeah. Right. So we have the opportunity to create when we come down here.
Right. And so you elevate the mundane to the spiritual.
Which is brand new. In other words, because that didn't exist. And in place of darkness to transform it to light, that's an incredible thing. That's what the soul does. However, Beit Shammai would maintain the soul can do it, right? Yeah, how do we know? Because it does it. So it can do it. Even in heaven, it had that potential. We're fine. Don't have to go down. What, it has to actually do it? It doesn't have to actually do it. If you know you can do it, it's also fine. Beit Hillel says, no. You got to actually do it. So it's better that it comes down than not come down. That's a dispute. Okay, so now we have clear, right? We have two ideas. And we're going to connect them in a moment. Two ideas. Shammai is strict. Hillel is loving. Shammai is potential. Hillel is practical. What's now the connection between these two ideas? How do we merge them together? Get ready for this. Strict, gvura, chumra, being strict, Beit Shammai, Shammai's strictness. I'm sorry, let me try again. Beit Shammai's sternness, being stern, is an expression of helem, concealment. Whereas love is an expression of revelation. Why? Love means giving. Love means openness. Giving and not judging. Everything's being on full display. Everything's being given. Gvura, the energy of Gvura is withholding. Chesed is to give. Gvura is to withhold. Hillel shares Torah with his fellow on one foot. Shammai says, no, you don't get my Torah like that. You got to come back respectfully. It's not nice. One foot. Who are you? Right. He keeps it hidden. So Gvura, Shammai, is concealment, hiding. And Chesed, Hillel, is revealing, giving. That's connected to potential and actual. Shammai, who's about concealing, always sees the concealment, i.e. the potential, that is still yet to be revealed. In other words, potential is hidden. And Shammai is connected with hiddenness, so Shammai loves potential. Shammai is all into that potential, all into hidden things. That's Shammai's forte. Hillel's sandbox is revelation, love and giving and practical. What have you done for me? What's actually happening? That's Hillel. And so now we have a very good understanding of why Shammai and Hillel count differently. The first exposition given in the Talmud, the first understanding of the dispute, the Talmud has two ways to understand the dispute. We know the dispute, either start 8 to 1 or 1 to 8. Why? The first opinion was because one looks at the days yet to come and one looks at the days that have come in. Okay, well this makes sense. Shammai, or the Academy of Shammai, that always looks at potential, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Hillel, why? Because again, concealment, potential, look at the 8, fine. And Hillel, who looks at who's chesed, giving, and who is practical, 1, and then 2, and then 3, and then 4, and 5. The question is, how is this connected with the second way of explaining the dispute? The bulls of Sukkot or going up in matters of holiness, what's the second explanation? And here's the answer. We're going to do it very quickly, but hopefully this will pack a massive punch. There are two ways, two perspectives on how to deal with darkness. Two general worldviews. This is reflected in psychology. This is reflected in self-improvement, self-growth, self-help. Two approaches to dealing with darkness, whether it's outside of you or inside of you. Two general approaches. One, focus on the problem. Two, focus on the solution. It's two different ways. Either you focus on that which is dark and ugly and messed up to try to understand why it's messed up, and right, like Freud. It's like, what's the problem and where did that come from and what's the issue and how do you feel about the issue? Right, all that grappling in the mud. Right? Then there's another approach. The other approach is doing the next positive thing. Don't worry about all the mud. Do something positive. Or like behavioral therapy. Just change what you're doing. Don't focus on why you're not doing what you should be doing. Just do something positive. Do something good. And everything's going to change from that. So it's not only like how you feel versus what you're doing. It's more of a general approach. Do you battle the darkness? Or do you create more light and the darkness will go away on its own? See the difference? Do you focus on the dark or do you focus on the light that you can create? Okay, these are two general approaches. Shammai, we said, Shammai is about concealment, gvura, stern and concealment and potential. So what he looks at is the darkness. Chanukah represents a battle between the dark and the light, between what's not good and what is good. And so in Chanukah, there's two approaches. One is to say, let's look at the problem. Let's look at the darkness. Let's look at the evil. Let's look at what's messed up in the world. And there's a lot of things that are messed up. So there's a lot of problems. So we say, how many candles do you need to light? You have to come at this problem with full force because there's all this darkness that's here. There's all this stuff that's messed up. And therefore, you need a lot of strength to wrestle with this fierce darkness. That's Shammai's approach. Hillel's approach is very different. Hillel says, why are you focusing on the darkness? Focus on what's in front of you. And what's in front of you is your positive deed. Don't focus on what needs to be fixed in the larger world, all the potential things, all the things that need to still be fixed, and it's so much stuff, and therefore I need all my power, all my eight lights. No. Focus on you, and focus on what you can do right now. One mitzvah, one good deed, one positive behavioral change, one positive action, one good deed. Do that, and you create light. And the next night, build on that and do two. And the next night, three. It's two approaches. One approach is you focus on the problem and minimize it, and one is to focus on the solution and maximize it. This is the distinction between the psychological and spiritual distinction between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Beit Shammai says, look at the world and all its problems, and you need to come out guns blazing. You have to come out with your massive torch of light and go after that darkness. The next night, it's kind of like violent video games. Right? Violent, right? Remember those like arcade games, whatever, like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? You have the bad guy or whoever it is that you're against. They have like a power bar. Even you have like a power, like a meter of how much strength energy you have left. Help me out here, right? Right? And then as you hit the guy, it goes down. It gets lower and lower. Right? Their strength, the enemy's strength, decreases as you wallop them. So this is Shammai's approach. Shammai says, you come out full force and you wallop the darkness. And you'll see that darkness will decrease little by little. Its energy, the force of darkness will decrease. The focus is on the problem. So it gets smaller and smaller. So you decrease the light you don't have to produce as much light because the enemy, the opposition is that much has been shrinking. So you don't need as much. Okay. Hillel says, no, don't focus on the darkness. Why are you thinking so much about the problems? Right? It's like, what are all my problems and how do I deal with it? What's the next good thing? Let me do something positive. Let me just create one small positive change in my life. One small positive action. And then capitalize and then do another one the next day. And automatically, if I focus on the good and the good that I can do, little by little, the darkness will fade away. How do I deal with negative thoughts? With self-defeating thoughts? With depressing thoughts? What, I'm gonna wrestle with them? You're going to wrestle with them, it's not going to end well. The only way to do it is by just thinking the next positive thought. You think a positive thought, and that automatically dispels the negative thought. That's Hillel's approach. And that's the approach that we take, according to Jewish law, according to halacha. The halacha is that we follow Hillel. We don't focus on the darkness. We focus on creating light. This is all connected. It's connected to the idea of a stricter approach versus a more loving approach. Either beat yourself up, or beat the darkness up, or just focus on the light. Forget the negativity. Just focus on the positive, and the negative will automatically go away. That's the nature of light. So Hillel and Shammai and Hillel. And potential versus actual. Are you focusing on the potential of the darkness to harm you, so you need 8 and then 7, 6, 4, 5, 6? Or do you focus on the actual of goodness that you're doing, the practical reality of the goodness that you're doing, 1 today, 2 tomorrow, and increase? We also understand now why Shammai compares it to the bulls of Sukkot. Remember I told you that there were 70 bulls that were brought? Do you know why 70? Did I explain why? 70 nations. 70 nations of the world. In Jewish tradition, there are 70, there's the Jewish nation, and then there's 70, generally speaking, 70 other nations of the world. What does it mean? And what do the bulls of Sukkot do? The bulls of Sukkot were brought as an offering in decreasing order in order to take away the power of oppression and subjugation, negativity of the nations of the world. In other words, it was symbolically meant to evoke this idea of that may God take away the negative forces of the world. It should decrease. The energy of the negative should decrease. 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7. It should go down. So Shammai says, oh, there's our precedent. Take the negativity and bring it and minimize it. That's Hanukkah. Hillel says like this, okay, you found the precedent. And there is a place to deal with the negativity and minimize it. Okay, fine. But not on Hanukkah. Hanukkah, we revert back to our status quo, which is always increase in matters of holiness. Don't focus so much on the negative. If the Torah says, for Sukkot you have to, well, that's Sukkot. But today is Hanukkah, it's not Sukkot. And so today we focus on the next good thing that we can do. So in summation, these two opinions of how to light the menorah are really two opinions about how to deal with the negativity in our lives. Do you grapple and do you get enmeshed in the negativity of your coworker, of your boss, of your spouse, of your neighbor, of your uncle? Do you get enmeshed in all the negativity and try to figure out and grapple and schmooze and discuss and get all worked up about it? Or and hopefully that'll minimize the problem and you know, push them away? Or do we focus on just doing good things? What we can do in the most immediate way, in the most practical way, is doing the next good thing for us. The Hanukkah message is, the halacha is, the latter. Do the next good thing. And the negativity, the darkness, will automatically fall. May we all have a bright Hanukkah and create more light in our lives that will then impact ourselves, our families, our communities, and the world at large. And let us say, Amen.